Every day, we share our financial details, credit card numbers, and other private information with complete strangers in the virtual world, while in the real world, we might not feel comfortable even telling people we meet face-to-face where we live. We shop, date, chat, and trade online, trusting the system that's been set up for us to conduct those transactions. It's the nature of the very globalized digital world in which we live. But how secure is the information we share online? What do we risk when we decide to participate in this digital world? Bishop Glennie's latest book is Dark Market, Cyber Thieves, Cyber Cops, and You. It's published by Knopf, and I'm very pleased to welcome Mr. Glennie back to our show. Hi.
Hi, thanks very much.
Have you given up being a broadcaster totally?
No, I still make series for the BBC now and then, a documentary series, but I'm entirely freelance, so I write, I broadcast, everything really.
After writing your first book, McMafia, now this one, do you still buy and trade online?
I do. I have changed my habits, partly because when I was researching Dark Market, one of the primary sources were cyber criminals, and they explained to me some of the things they do, and so some of the things that I don't do as a consequence now. And so my behavior has changed. For example, one thing that people may not know, that banks will compensate you for money if your credit card is compromised. But if you have a business account and that account is compromised, they won't compensate you. So I shifted all my money from a business account, because I'm a sort of company myself, as it were, and had to put them in a personal account.
A friend of mine just went through this the other day, where all of the money that she had to pay her employees in a restaurant was taken out by somebody. They have pictures of this woman, but she's been told she will not be compensated
she won't
for
get compensated.
Even though the bank gave her the money, gave this stranger all of her money.
It's absolutely shocking, this sort of thing, and it's the sort of thing that you have to find out now, because we are dealing with so much of our data online, and in various instances we are very vulnerable. If our identity is stolen, for example, there were one or two cases I came across researching Dark Market, then your lives are devastated. There was one man I met who was arrested at Zurich Airport because his identity had been stolen and someone had passed themselves off as him and then committed a crime. He was on Interpol's most wanted list. It was really shocking.
In this book, you follow the rise and fall of the dark market criminal website, which took you from California to Turkey, of all places. What exactly is dark market?
Dark Market was the premier English language criminal website from 2005 to 2008, and it was basically
three and a half years,
in fact. It was a sort of department store for criminals operating online. So they'd log in. It was like a forum. You'd have to be vetted, first of all. And then you could buy and sell stolen credit card details. You could buy and sell viruses. You could take tutorials on how to commit cyber crimes and so on. And it was incredibly popular.
And how did it get started?
It got started because there emerged a tradition in 2001 when a group of Ukrainians in the Black Sea port of Odessa started a criminal website called Carder Planet, and this became the model, which was then copied all over the world. And a group of guys, one of them from Britain, one from Germany, one from Turkey, they decided to set this one up, and very successful it was too.
And Turkey seems to be a center for this kind of activity. Why?
Well, initially we saw Brazil, Russia, China as big places for the incubation of cybercrime, but it then started spreading. And what's a particular sort of focus of cybercriminal activity is countries which are emerging markets, very strong, with good education systems, but quite a degree of inequality in terms of wealth, and very entrepreneurial young men in particular who see this as an opportunity.
My guest is Misha Glennie, whose latest book is Dark Market, Cyber Thieves, Cyber Cops, and You, published by Knopf. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. When and under what circumstances was Dark Market brought down?
Well, There were five administrators on Dark Market, and one of those administrators was an undercover agent of the FBI.
Even though he'd been vetted?
He'd been vetted, and that's because he'd taken a long time painstakingly creating an identity in the cyber underworld as somebody who was a reliable criminal. Now, they had some systems for identifying whether the person you're dealing with is a trustworthy criminal. Of course, that was slightly difficult to ascertain, but they did find mechanisms, and they had some mechanisms for identifying undercover agents. But this one, Agent Malarski, who was based in Pittsburgh, managed to get around that. And he slowly gathered material on all the people who were working online. He got to know them very well in their sort of virtual identities, more or less as friends, and then started to plot how he would then bring them down.
So when it was brought down, was that a significant blow to cybercrime, or just does something else spring up almost immediately?
Well, what the end of Dark Market meant was the end of these sort of one-stop shop forums. And instead, the criminal underworld online has gone deeper and it has become more sophisticated. People are less likely to communicate on public forums like that. And instead, they are creating real sort of syndicates online, which are much more difficult to penetrate. Crime is on the increase on the web all the time, and it's shifting.
Well, we've talked a lot on the show recently about how much government and web services like Google and Facebook can learn about us. What about cyber criminals?
Well, they are, on the whole, opportunistic. What they're looking for is any type of information that you're giving out online, which they can monetize one way or another.
But we always say that they are totally safe. My bank tells me that I have nothing to worry about.
That's absolutely right. Although, of course, we remember that Citigroup, Citibank, was regarded until recently as the safest bank for online banking in the United States. And yet, just over 2 months ago, they lost 200,000 account details. And so I would be a little wary of what banks are telling you about online banking. As long as they're prepared to compensate you for their errors, that's fine, but we need to learn ourselves, because we will often find ourselves in situations whereby we don't get compensated.
Well, but they're constantly encouraging us to go online. They don't like the fact that I insist on depositing money waiting online in a bank.
That's because if you bank online, you're saving them money, because they don't have to pay the tellers and they don't have to pay the branch infrastructure. So for them, if we were all to get scared about online banking, they'd have to start investing money back in bricks and mortar branches.
But we're not constantly being watched. We just happen to be coincidental to the whole thing.
We are. We're arbitrary victims. But the problem is that over the past 10 years, you've seen the industrialization of cybercrime, really, whereby, you know, on phishing scams, for example, where people persuade you to click on something which will download a virus onto your computer, they're not attacking you, Lenny Lopate, specifically. They're attacking any sucker who clicks on that link. And one of the interesting things about cybercrime is although it requires usually someone with real technical skills, a sort of geeky type personality, I would say about 70 to 80% of cybercrime is a result of something we call social engineering, which is persuading you to do things which objectively are not, in fact, in your interest.
Well, I get all of these offers to check out my Social Security funds, to find out, I don't know, about all sorts of things that I obviously have nothing to do with, I guess. And I always think, what idiot would ever give them a Social Security number and all the other information they want? But I guess there are a lot of people out there who do.
Unfortunately, is there's one born every minute. Is that, you know, we can be easily persuaded to do things, because remember, the internet is a tool of convenience, and Also, never forget things like we want to be loved. I mean, it's no coincidence that
we want somebody to give us money.
The successful online virus of one of the most successful of all times was called I Love You. And so you got this email with this strap line, I Love You. Now, I was very lucky because I got it from an ex-girlfriend, first of all, and I knew all sorts of things she felt towards me, but love was not amongst them. And so I was able to escape myself the infection. But you've got to be really careful about what you're reading and doing online.
Is cybercrime more common because we're using computers more or because the tools that the cybercriminals use are becoming more refined?
There is a constant battle, a sort of sword and shield battle between people engaged in cybersecurity and people engaged in cybercrime. It's very difficult for cyber cops to protect us because we have all sorts of different jurisdictions. And, of course, the internet is a globalized phenomenon, and so cyber thieves can be, they can plan an attack, say, in Ukraine, carry it out in the US, and cash out the money in Dubai. So it's much harder for the cyber cops than the cyber thieves.
Well, we hear all of these terms, malware, viruses, of course, phishing. Are they all related?
Yes, they are. I mean, they're all part of the arsenal that is used to try and infiltrate networked computer systems. And I mean, sometimes, you know, some rather dreadful things happen. We've just recently, in the past week, been researching a system that the German police used in order to try and tap people online, to have a surveillance system online. And this program they had, which was built specially for them, has got out onto the internet, and anyone can download it and use it against their opponents. So, you know, there's some really weird stuff out there.
So how do we even notice that something's happened? If our bank accounts or credit cards are hacked, we have to look carefully to notice whether there have been strange payments in Bulgaria or Switzerland.
Yeah, well, that happened to me as I was writing the book. I got a phone call from my bank, and the very suave gentleman at the end of the line said, "Hello, Mr. Glennie, have you recently been purchasing large amounts of jewellery in Sofia, Bulgaria?" And I said, "No." "And what about Swiss Telecom, 4,000 Swiss francs?" I said, "No, not at all." He says, "Don't worry, it's all right. Your credit card has been compromised, but it's all paid for. Don't worry about it." Now, the issue there is so if I'm not paying for it, is the bank paying for it? No, the bank gets it from their insurance company. And the insurance company, of course, puts its premiums up to account for that. And what the bank then does is it puts the charges for all of its customers up. So this idea that it's a victimless crime simply isn't true. Ultimately, it's the customers who are paying for it.
And do they generally catch the person who has bought all that jewelry under your name?
No. Unfortunately, this is a relatively low-risk, high-return criminal activity. Now, one of the great things about cybercrime and cybercriminals is they're not violent, because, of course, it's very difficult to be violent on the web. And so that's a sort of positive aspect to cybercrime. But in terms of what you do about it, because it's a very widespread phenomenon now, heaven only knows.
So this wasn't a dangerous topic for you to research?
It wasn't as dangerous as McMafia. But what is happening now is that you're seeing a migration of traditional organized crime syndicates over to cyber because they realize that it's a much lower risk for them. So, you know, things are shifting out there.
My guest is Misha Glennie, former BBC Central Europe correspondent. He covered the fall of communism and the wars in the former Yugoslavia. He's also the author of McMafia, The Rebirth of History, The Fall of Yugoslavia, which won the Overseas Press Club Award in 1993 for Best Book on Foreign Affairs. Also, The Balkans, Nationalism, War, and the Great Powers, 1804 to 1999. And now, a slightly different tack, we have Dark Market. That's one word, by the way, with two capital letters, the D and the M. Cyber Thieves, Cyber Cops, and You. It is published by Knopf. Stay with us for more. We're back with Misha Glennie, whose latest book is Dark Market, Cyber Thieves, Cyber Cops, and You. It's published by Knopf. You say that there are three major levels of threats on the web: consumer cybercrime, which we've been talking about, cyber industrial espionage, and cyber warfare. Can you describe what we mean when we cybercrime is all the stuff that we've been talking about, also ATM skimming, I guess, some other scams. What about industrial espionage? How does that work, and is it related?
This accounts for about, it's estimated about a third of malfeasance on the web, and essentially there are two types of it. One is competitors hacking into rival companies to find out what their sales strategy is going to be like, what their product development is going to be, and stealing a march on the competitors using that information. So traditional industrial espionage, except it's much, much easier if you can just hack them.
Are they using similar tools to the cyber criminals?
Oh,
prey on individuals?
Absolutely. They're using the same techniques. And what you're finding is with those three pillars of cybercrime, industrial espionage, and cyber warfare, there are two communities which drift between the three of them. One are the hackers, whose abilities are required in all three sectors, and the other, interestingly enough, are intelligence agents. So while I was researching a book about cybercrime, I would come across characters from the Turkish intelligence service, from the KGB, all investigating the cyber criminals because of the fact that they may have had links with other groups involved in industrial espionage or even in cyber warfare.
Well, in some cases, there are accusations that cyber warfare and industrial espionage is in the national interest of some countries.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, to be honest, Lenny, everyone's at it now. And there's a huge amount of bad stuff going out there because people are trying to steal a march the whole time, using espionage, sucking up lots of data and information. You will have heard over the weekend, possibly, that there has been a virus that has affected the drones which are being used over Afghanistan and northwest Pakistan. That virus almost certainly didn't get there accidentally. Now, they don't know what it does.
But it logs the pilot's keystrokes, I gather.
That's right. And it's very, very worrying that most weaponry nowadays is extremely dependent on very complex computer systems. And if you can develop a virus that interferes or controls those systems, then things can go badly wrong.
But, of course, it will allow the government to blame any errant drone attack on some cyber criminal rather than...
I'm sure we'll have cases of that in future. But we have to recognize that, most major countries have now got advanced cyber offensive weaponry programs, including the U.S., including Britain, including China, Israel, and so on.
So I imagine it's very difficult to arrest anybody, considering the fact that this is often part of government policy.
It's difficult to... Well, what's happening is governments are beginning to legislate so that freelance hacking, attacking governments and institutions, is illegal, but they themselves are arrogating the right to create these sorts of weapons in defense of the realm, as it were.
We hear about governments going to Google and Yahoo and other websites and asking for help. Are they implicated somewhere?
Well, you've got to remember that in the sort of nightmare scenario of an attack on computer systems which control the so-called critical national infrastructure, that much of the critical national infrastructure, be it power supplies, telecoms, utilities like water, they are dependent on the private sector. Private sector companies, Windows, for example. I mean, most viruses are made for Windows, and most computer systems run on them. And so you have to have the cooperation of Microsoft if you were suddenly the subject of a major attack.
Somebody has recently suggested that the reason we didn't see viruses affecting Apple products as much is because they weren't prevalent, but now Apple is the predominant platform. So perhaps we'll be seeing more viruses for Apple, or is it
that Windows is... As soon as we reach a critical mass on Apple products out there, then there will be a flood of viruses. At the moment, we haven't reached that critical mass yet, but given the success of iPads and iPhones, I think at some point soon we will reach that critical mass.
Now, you talked about viruses as a matter of national policy. That's been suggested with the Stuxnet worm that was planted in Iran's nuclear facilities.
Yep, that was Iran's enrichment facilities at Natanz and Bushehr. Now, what that does, because it was a particularly sophisticated virus, it took about 6 months, a team of people about 6 months to produce, and we know that from the guys who have reverse-engineered it, who've sort of picked it apart, that only the resources of a state could have produced that thing. So what happened with Stuxnet, which was one of those things that could have led to an explosion in a nuclear enrichment plant, i.e. the very stuff of nightmares, is that one state, we don't know who it is, or a coalition, is putting their hand up and saying, we have got this technology. Not only that, we have the ability to deploy it.
Well, there are all sorts of suspicions as to who created Stuxnet. Would retaliation be possible? Earlier this year, the United States declared that in some special cases, the right to respond to cyber attacks with military force would be a possibility.
The great concern about this is that for the moment, a really sophisticated computer user hacker can disguise where he or she is attacking from. And as long as that issue of anonymity exists, then you may have a 90% supposition. You may be 90% correct in your supposition as to where that attack is coming from, but usually you cannot be 100% sure. And so it may well be that someone is pushing you into one direction where actually it's coming from another. So you have to be very careful about real-time retaliation.
Is the United States the most technologically advanced country in this field, or are other countries catching up?
The U.S. is without question the most advanced, but Russia, China, and latterly France, Britain, Germany, and also Israel are beginning to develop extremely sophisticated operations.
What's your take on WikiLeaks? Haven't some of its critics associated it with cybercrime?
No, I wouldn't say they've associated with cybercrime. This is very interesting because the whole phenomenon of the hacktivists, particularly the people who supported Assange, the groups Anonymous and Lulzsec, who attack sites like PayPal and Amazon because they wouldn't help, withdrew the funding facilities for, the PayPal facilities for Assange. Those groups do the same sort of thing as criminals, but they are motivated differently. They are essentially political and ideological. They are not doing things for their own pecuniary gain. And I think this is an important difference. Of course, if you look at Assange himself, what he's done, and we've seen this last week with the Obama's latest set of regulations on how information should be shared within government, is he has achieved the opposite in one sense that he wanted, is there's going to be a lockdown on data now in the US government. And I'm sure those people who favor more secretive systems of government will be pleased by those decisions.
Which U.S. organizations are dealing with cybersecurity? I would assume the FBI, the National Security Agency, Department of Homeland Security. Are they cooperating?
Well, as always, you have a proliferation of agencies in the U.S. dealing with this. There is still the traditional rivalry between the Secret Service and the FBI when it comes to cybercrime in particular, and they often bump into each other and get in each other's way. Then you have the Department for Homeland Security, which is supposed to be protecting the so-called critical national infrastructure. But the really sensational thing is the creation just recently, a year or so ago, of U.S. Cybercom. The fifth military domain has been created, and it's the first ever man-made military domain, which I think is an absolutely fascinating concept.
But since this is an international thing, can we deal with it on a national level?
No, you can't. You have to cooperate, and the United States initially was very reluctant to cooperate in treaty terms with other countries because they believed that the motives of the Russians and the Chinese were somehow suspect. But I think all of the major powers are now moving towards a position where, even if they can't get a treaty together, that they have to start agreeing on certain practices in cyberspace because things are becoming too cacophonous out there.
You met with some of the most effective cyber cops. You mentioned Keith Mularski of the FBI, but also Bilal Sen of the Turkish police. How are they different than normal cops?
Well, they're quite not in the case of Keith. Keith's a very sort of ordinary guy. He's not a great geeky sort of person. Bilal was rather different, very quiet, very thoughtful, the very opposite of a sort of Balkan Turkish policeman. Keith was a very sort of brash product of Pittsburgh and with a very straight sense of right and wrong, a great salesman and great fun. And Bilal was more of a sort of, he was a sort of Hercule Poirot of the Turkish police, which I really loved.
You also met some of the criminals, the hackers, in prison?
That was critical. Most of them, the majority were in prison, but there are three of them who I met who are still active criminals, who I still talk to regularly, and they're very useful for me because they tell me what's happening next, as it were.
Don't they want to remain secret?
It took me months and months to get these guys to talk to me, and that was the real strain in researching the book. But eventually they did.
Well,
how did
you get in touch with them?
I got in touch partly through contacts, partly through forums. There are sort of forums that hackers use. And I would sit there saying, does anyone know any information about this? Would they be willing to talk to me? And eventually they agreed to do it. And again, after months of communicating with them on the web, they finally agreed to meet me in person. And so we had these sort of clandestine meetings in various parts of the world.
And they have all these interesting names. Iceman, Lord Cyric, is it?
Lord Cyric.
Cyric. Jill C, or Matrix 001.
Yeah, they have this sort of fantasy world that is informed in part by a sort of half-baked anarchism, in part by the sort of culture around games like Dungeons and Dragons. And they like to see themselves as sort of cloak and dagger figures. They're often highly intelligent, often very good at math and physics and subjects like that, and really extremely different as characters from those people who I met when I was researching McMafia, who were much more sort of run-of-the-mill mafia type figures.
Do they work as freelancers, or are they part of organizations?
They tend to work as freelancers. We're now seeing more of the emergence of coalitions, temporary coalitions, between people with different skills on the web. But on the whole, they are individualists above all.
And they've developed a language kind of based on English, no matter what country they come from?
Yes, it's a sort of sub-dialect of Globish, the English as a second language thing. And, of course, what the advantage of this is you can't actually tell where they come from. Whereas if you look, say, at some of the Russian criminal websites, it's very difficult for agencies like the FBI to penetrate the Russian criminal websites because they can spot a non-Russian user, a non-native Russian speaker, a Malov. And even when the FBI are deploying native Russian speakers, what they will do on Russian websites is use the latest slang to see whether people are keeping up with them. And so English, in a sense, is a facilitator of global cybercrime because you can never tell where the person you're talking to comes from.
We often hear that security organizations and governments hire some of these hackers, these criminal hackers, as consultants.
As in my opinion, I think they should, actually, because, you know, they have an extraordinary knowledge of what is actually going out there. Now, a lot of them, the ones I met certainly, not only come from very different places, although they come from very different places, they share certain characteristics. They get involved in hacking when they're very young. That means they get involved in hacking and criminal activity before they've really developed a moral compass. And a lot of them, by the time they understand that what they're doing is maybe not the right thing, they would love to work with computers in a legitimate industry because it's really the only skill they have. But I don't think that we offer them enough chance to rehabilitate themselves.
Have estimates been made of how much this is costing government and private security companies?
Well, the latest figure put out by the White House, as it happens, about 3 or 4 weeks ago, is that cyber malfeasance costs us $1 trillion a year. But before you go running for the hills, you have to bear in mind that these figures are plucked out of the air, frankly. We can't tell how much money we're losing to cybercrime. We can tell how much we're spending on trying to protect ourselves. And that, at the moment, is something in the region worldwide of about $100 billion a year, and it's likely to double within about 5 years.
And if you had to forecast the next 30 years, how do you think the digital world will evolve?
It's very hard to say. But I think it will take us off in directions that we haven't yet thought of. What does worry me is the fact that some of the really nasty malware can just slip out onto the net and it will be exploited by some very bad people. We really have to take care about this. And what's more, ordinary people, unfortunately, it's difficult because it's a tedious, it's an arcane, and it's a tricky subject to get your head around. We all have to start learning something about it.
You think we'll ever see something like a cyber Interpol?
Well, we're getting regional cyber Interpols at the moment. The European Union is desperately trying to create a European police force. The FBI has very good contacts with Europe. But, you know, when it comes to cooperating with Russia, China, South Africa, Brazil, it's much, much harder because we don't have these close relations with all countries around the world. It's going to be really tricky, that.
Misha Glenny, G-L-E-N-N-Y, his book, Dark Market, Cyber Thieves, Cyber Cops, and You. It is published by Knopf. And I want to thank you so much for being on our show today. It's been fascinating, and now I'm really scared.
Thanks a lot, Lenny. I appreciate it.